And I arrived last night, so this is my good day. We'll see what the jet lag will probably kick in tomorrow. But at least I should be awake for this talk, which is good. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of different stuff. So as well as talking about de Broglie bone mechanics, I want to say some general things about the nature of the quantum state, and then at the end tie that back into to specifics about de Broglie bone mechanics. As a consequence of this, I won't actually have a great deal of time in my talk to introduce de Broglie bone mechanics, but there are a number of people who will be talking later in this conference who've done a great deal more research than I have in the area, and so I hope that if my introduction is not completely clear, I hope at least it gives you, for those people who aren't familiar with the theory, that it gives you some flavor of it and that it will become clearer as the week progresses. Okay, so I won't go bother going through that. So I'm going to begin, as I said, with some preliminaries. So in deference to Chris's, I think, terminology for, is this your, what you call, Bohmianity is a religion? Anyway, to begin with, to my disclaimer that I do not believe in, or I do not believe that de Broglie bone mechanics is true. I do not believe de Broglie bone mechanics is false. Okay, so I'm not giving this talk from the point of view of a true believer, but I'm also certainly not dishing it, because what I do believe is that de Broglie bone mechanics should be understood by everyone professing an interest in quantum foundations, and for these reasons. Firstly, to lessen the number of blatantly wrong things that are said in the field, because it's a, I mean, often those things which are said as facts simply don't apply to Bohmian mechanics, which is a perfectly good theory. Secondly, and I guess this is in some sense the same point, is to act as a foil for intuition. If you have an idea about what must be true about all interpretations, you should test it against Bohmian mechanics to see whether it holds in that instant. Thirdly, to provoke new ways of thinking about quantum foundations, and I guess that's where this talk fits in, I'd say that way. And fourthly, which Bohm certainly had in mind from the beginning, to suggest or perhaps constrain new fundamental theories that go beyond quantum mechanics, but I'm not really going to talk about that in this talk. Okay, so continuing with the apologies. So just to demonstrate that I am impartial with respect to interpretation of quantum mechanics, and the bit about discouragement from Rob and Hugh. That's of course Rob Speckens and Hugh Price. That's not to say that they're discouraging me from expressing my opinions, just that they don't seem to think that the way I do it is very funny, whereas that was the intention. So this is my attempted humorous thing. So I used to believe in Everett's interpretation. Now I'm in two minds. I used to believe in the Barbaverse, but that was a different world. I used to believe in Fuchs' interpretation, but no one else was of like mind. I used to believe the Bohr's tenets were true. Now I see they were profound. I used to believe in pilot wave theory. Now my beliefs have drifted. And finally, I used to believe in retrocausality, but there was no future in it. Okay, well, I got some chuckles. So. All right, so moving on now to the slightly more serious part. So I thought before getting on to talking about these issues that it would be good to analyze the terms in the title for this conference. And so to begin with, what do we mean when we use the term the quantum state? And it seems to me that there are three different ways, at least, in which we could use this term. And I think we've Probably, well, anyway, let's just get on with it. So certainly the first one has been used, I think, and that's when we use a state vector, or more likely a state matrix or density operator, applying to some small, in some sense, laboratory system on which we do experiments. Okay, so that's what I call, well, okay, so that's applying it to what I call objects. Then we have the idea of applying a quantum state to objects and subjects, where the subjects are basically all the subjects that might exist except for me. Okay, so this is singling out myself as being special in some way, but I'm not limiting myself to describing just things which are in the laboratory. It could be the entire rest of the universe except for me. And then the third thing that I could apply a quantum state to is totality. Okay, the whole of the universe, or even perhaps the multiverse, including myself in it. Okay, so those are those three ways. And then I think we also need to analyze the word nature, you know, the nature of the quantum state. Well, what are the possible natures that things can have in physical theories? And I'm sure this is not a complete list, but I think at least this is a list of relevant ones in terms of talking about quantum state. So the first is, I'll call the instrumental nature, which I think operational is means basically the same thing. And I think in reference to talking about quantum states or states, that this is more or less the same thing as the statistical nature that Leslie Ballantyne talked about this morning, but I'm not 100% sure about that. Anyway, basically, so an instrumental nature means that this thing that we're talking about encapsulates what I or we expect to happen in the future, depending on how I or we interact with whatever it is that the construct in question is applying to. Okay, so in other words, that if it's a state, a quantum state, it's whatever that's the quantum state of, an instrumental interpretation of that would mean that, you know, just a quantum state is just encapsulating, you know, the results of future measurements that I might make on the system. So I want to distinguish that from what I'll call an epistemic nature of something, is that that encapsulates what I or we believe or know about the configuration of whatever it applies to. Okay, so about the thing itself, not about what might happen in the future if I interact with it. Third nature is ontic, which means that it encapsulates at least partly, you know, the configuration itself of whatever it applies to. In other words, it's, you know, what's the real state, or you know, what is the true state of affairs about the thing that I'm talking about. And finally, gnomic, which will come up later, means that it's talking about not so much, you know, what happens to be, but rather the most fundamental laws of nature, okay, the things which are least contingent in the universe. So obviously there's no hard lines between these things, but at least I think it's useful to list the as different concepts. Okay, so that's the terms. So then just I wanted to spend a couple of slides being clear about making this distinction between instrumental and epistemic, because it seems to me that this is often blurred or sort of rushed over. And I think that Lucy and Hardy pointed out the difference very well in this paper from a couple of years ago. And so this is a quote just to show that I think he's using the term instrumental state in the same way that I'm using it. He said, the instrumental state of a system, so again, I've colored that to indicate that here this is talking about, I believe, just a laboratory system, is defined to be that thing which uniquely determines the probability associated with every outcome of every measurement that may be performed on the system. Okay, so it's about what may happen in the future. And so what Lucian, just to emphasize this difference between instrumental and epistemic, was to define this number K instrumental, so that K instrumental minus 1 is the number of positive numbers, which I can think of as being probabilities, which are required to specify this instrumental state. So in quantum theory, that number is D squared minus 1, where D is the dimension of the Hilbert space. This is a simple counting argument for looking at the state matrix for a given Hilbert space. Okay, so then what Lucian also talked about was a different number, K ontic. Okay, so where K ontic minus 1 is the number of, again, positive numbers or probabilities required to specify the epistemic state, that is the state of knowledge. Now, by definition, the number of probabilities required to specify an epistemic state is equal to the number of different ontic states with the system can be in. Because a state of knowledge is a state of knowledge about the true state of affairs of the system, about the ontic state of the system. So, you know, it may be in this state, it may be in that state, it may be in another state. Okay. So however many ontic states you have, the epistemic state would require that many probabilities to specify. And then what Lucian points out, so in classical probability theory, these numbers are the same. The number of probabilities required for the instrumental state is the same. Is the same as that. Lucian called it K ontic. I guess I would think that to make it, that it would probably be clearer to in fact call this K epistemic, because then I can interpret, you know, K in the same way. It's the number of probabilities required to specify that sort of state. But the point is that in quantum theory, okay, the number of different ontic states has got to be at least greater than or equal to the number of different psi, the number of different wave functions that my system can have, because certainly every different psi gives me different outcomes from my experiment, so it has to at least correspond to a different true state of affairs. And so a consequence of that is that K ontic divided by K instrumental is infinity in the quantum case, which is what Lucian called the ontological excess baggage theorem. Okay, so, I mean, and this is, I guess I wanted to just emphasize this to point out the enormous difference between an epistemic state and an instrumental state in quantum mechanics. This doesn't say, you know, exactly what this number is, but it says that it has to be at least, you know, an infinity of a certain order if I have to take into account all the different possible psi's. Now, some of you are probably thinking, but, you know, we've heard lots of people talk about, you know, how quantum states are closely analogous to classical probability distributions. And I think, so Carl Caves took a whole talk last year in the PF meeting we had in Sydney to make this argument that these things are basically analogous. And the way that he made that argument was basically to look at a series of questions and to see that, to make a comparison then between on the one hand, something which is clearly epistemic, that is a probability distribution classically, and something which is clearly ontic, and that's the thing, you know, the position of my system or whatever it is classically. And to see, when asking those questions and asking in the quantum in the classical case, to see where do rho and psi fall, and what he pointed out, that there's a whole series of questions you can ask where rho and psi give the same answer as a classical probability distribution does, and a different answer from what X, an ontic, truly existing state of a classical system, would give. And so those questions were, first, can the outcome of a fine-grained measurement on this sort of state be predicted with certainty in general? So for any sort of quantum state, the answer is no, which is the same as with the classical probability distribution, whereas a definite classical state would give the answer yes. So, and by fine-grained here would basically correspond to a bijective measurement in the quantum case and just reading out the ontic state in the classical case. Second question, can a state of this sort be verified from a single measurement? The answer is no in the quantum case, and from the classical probability distribution, you can't tell what a classical distribution is from a single measurement, but you can tell what the true classical state is from a single measurement. So again, no and yes. Does this sort of state necessarily change upon measurement in general? Then the answer is yes for the quantum states and the probability distribution, no for the ontic state. Is there always a unique decomposition of a state into an ensemble of this sort of states? The answer there is no for the answer is no because of the non-uniqueness of decompositions of probability distributions into other probability distributions, or the non-uniqueness of decomposition of rho into an ensemble of psi's or other rho's. Whereas, of course, in the case where I have a definite position X, there's a unique decomposition because it's a trivial decomposition where X has to be the yeah, that there it only has one member. And finally, with this sort of state, does a measurement here change the state for over there in general? In other words, does there appear to be some sort of non-locality? And the answer is yes for the classical probability distribution, just because there's such things as classical correlations, and therefore making a measurement here leads me to update my state of knowledge for what's somewhere else. And of course, yes, in the quantum cases for the same sorts of reasons, but no for a completely specified classical state, because a measurement here doesn't actually teach me anything, so it doesn't change what's going on over there. So they seem like fairly good arguments for saying that the quantum state in this sense is an epistemic state. Okay, this is just the quantum state for objects, clearly. So it would seem like the question, aren't these things closely analogous? The answer would be yes, but then on the other hand, I think the answer is also no, because I can come up with an equally long list of measurement, list of questions in which I get a completely different outcome, and that is where rho and psi go together. In other words, answer the same way, but psi and x go together, okay? And so these are actually fairly closely related questions. So the first one, given a state of this sort, whichever one I'm considering, is there a fine-grained measurement whose outcome can be predicted with certainty? The answer is no for these cases, yes for those cases. Clearly just to project onto that state in the quantum case. Is it possible to unambiguously distinguish any two states of this sort with a single measurement? And so the point being, yeah, okay, so it doesn't say that this has to be with certainty. It's just that it's possible to get an outcome which will unambiguously distinguish any two of these. And the answer is no in the case of rho and p, but yes in the case of psi and x. Given a state of this sort, is there some fine-grained measurement I can perform which does not change the state? Again, no in the case of probability distributions or state matrices, but yes in the case of the state vector or x. And finally, are we onto that? No, still not finally. Is this equal to a non-trivial mixture of other states of the same sort? The answer is yes, again, for these, but no for the pure state at x. And finally, does knowledge of this state guarantee that no other parties have more information about the system? The answer is no for rho and p, but yes for psi and x. So it seems to me the conclusion to draw from all this is that the fine-grained instrumental state, psi, of an object is neither closely analogous to a classical ontic state nor closely analogous to a classical epistemic state. So it's just something different. An instrumental state is just, for a quantum system, is just different from either an ontic state or an epistemic state. Okay, and so finally in this section, before turning to the Broadbone mechanics, I just wanted to then say something about my attitudes to these various, you know, what I'm going to be talking about in the rest of the talk in terms of, you know, these various natures and types of states. So obviously, in terms of designing quantum gadgets, that's fun and a lucrative business. And to do that, all you require is the instrumental interpretation of the state for an object, for a laboratory thing. So for practical quantum mechanics, for all practical purposes, this is what you want to do, and you won't get into trouble. But in common with 3 out of the 4 talks so far, I'm going to quote Einstein. Note that the 3 of the 4 were physicists rather than philosophers. I presume that's significant. So to quote Einstein, I think that Einstein was talking about the serious business of a philosopher physicist is encapsulated by what he said. I'm not interested in this phenomenon or that phenomenon. I want to know God's thoughts, the rest of the details. And I'm afraid I don't have a reference for that, but I think it's a genuine quote. So the point is that, yes, I mean, I think that this is fine if what we want to do is design quantum gadgets, but if we're doing quantum foundations, I think this is not fine. We have to do better. So I'm not going to talk, I'm only interested in the instrumental interpretation, and it will come up, insofar as it emerges from more fundamental considerations, by which I mean talking about the epistemic, ontic, and gnomic states, if you like. And then, so another thing about my attitudes, talking now about what sort of states I'm interested in. I think that the idea of treating subjects, that is, other people, as fundamentally different from objects is some sort of Cartesian dualism. Okay, and I don't think that that's something, as physicists, that we should indulge in. So, therefore, I'm not interested in this object-only application for quantum states. I think that if we take things seriously, we have to think about what it means to talk about states for either totality, the entire universe, or possibly totality excluding me. I think something which is defensible, but I won't really be talking about that myself. Okay, so finally, getting on to part two, which is talking about the Breuer-Bohm interpretation. So one final sort of introduction to that. Before getting on to that, obviously the Breuer-Bohm theory is a hidden variable theory. Why should we be interested in hidden variables theories? So I think there are a number of reasons. First, I think many, perhaps most quantum physicists actually believe in hidden variables, even if they won't admit it. And for the simple reason that everyone except a solipsist needs an ontology. Needs to believe in something out there in the world. So then either you believe that the wave function and nothing else is ontic, or you believe that there's something else instead of or in addition to psi is real. So unless you're going to embrace one, then really you are saying that you do believe in hidden variables. Okay, so why else would we want to believe in hidden variables? I think secondly, to explain the probabilities that appear in the instrumentalist theory, or the instrumental theory. Secondly, to explain things like the existence of people who do experiments and observe results, etc., that are just assumed in the instrumental theory. In other words, not to take these as primitives. And then lastly, to suggest research towards a theory that might supersede that of quantum mechanics. All right, so the Breuer-Bohm theory, to begin, I'll put up the simplest form, which is just for a single particle, just to give people who haven't met it before a feel for how it works. So the basic idea is that you have a hidden variable, which is just the position of the particle, so this would just be a three vector. And if I have a Hamiltonian, a non-relativistic particle Hamiltonian like that, then the Breuer-Bohm theory says that the position of the particle evolves in time like this. It has a velocity which depends only on its position, and that velocity is simply given by the probability current divided by the probability, where this is the standard expression for the probability current. And so this is obviously satisfies the continuity equation, and what that tells you is that if you started off with a probability distribution for the particle position at time t naught to be the standard quantum mechanical probability distribution for position, then at all times in the future, if those positions evolve according to Bohmian mechanics, or de Broglie-Bohm mechanics, I should say, then it will still be the case that the probability distribution at a later time will be given by the standard quantum expression. And so just for anyone who hasn't seen some de Broglie-Bohm trajectories, here are some. This is a double slit. And showing how you can get interference pattern appearing through the motion of the particles. So the point being, of course, that the wave function is still very much part of the theory. Okay, that I can't make do just with the x, but it's a variable on top of psi that I'm doing this. Okay, so that was single particle Bohmian mechanics. But what we're interested in is more than that. We want the Breuer-Bohm mechanics for the whole universe. Now, there are many ways of generalizing this, and we'll probably hear some more details about that later in the week, I suggest. But this is, I'm just going to talk about one, my favorite way of doing that, and this is just to convince you that it is possible to do it. You don't have to follow this particular way, but that one can, in fact, so far as the standard model is well defined, you can make a model of de Broglie bone theory, which is adequate within that formalism. And so now, instead of having a free vector x as my hidden variable, I now have an infinity vector. Okay, and it's infinity because it includes the three positions of all the infinitely many particles in the universe. So there are infinitely many particles in the universe because the forgetting about cutoffs and things like that, you also have an infinitely large universe, and I don't want to get into the technical details, but anyway, so you've got a huge number, potentially infinite number of particles in the universe, and each one of these then has a Bohmian position associated with it, and is also going to be associated with a finite dimensional Hilbert space, which is not going to have any hidden variables associated with it, which encodes things like the spin, the lepton number, the color, the flavor, etc. of that particle. So in other words, the actual, you know, the theory doesn't say this particle is a quark, this particle is an electron, etc. It just says this is a particle, and so but the nature of that particle will in fact emerge from the way it behaves, which is, of course, you know, the way we identify particles in the laboratory. On top of that, X also contains the value of all the quantized gauge fields, so that's the electromagnetic field, the three weak fields, and the eight strong fields, at every point in space. So there's another, you know, obviously obvious infinity of variables which have to be included there. Now, of course, one wouldn't need to, you know, one could just pick out some subset of these variables and say that's going to be my x, but this is sort of the most complete way of doing it. So having defined that, if I now simply say that I'm going to generalize the expression for the velocity, so now this is obviously a velocity in configuration space, not a velocity in real space, I can define my velocity by this expression here. So it's a fairly nice expression. It just involves the commutator of the Hamiltonian with the operator for all of these, you know, well, for this particular variable that I'm considering here. And it involves the actual positions of all the other variables. And this, in the single particle case, simply reduces to what the expression which I put up before. Here, of course, this psi now is a universal wave function. I'm describing everything in the universe here. So just some quick asides. So this is obviously, Bohmian mechanics is explicitly a non-local theory in that we look at x dot for some particular variable. It depends on the position of an in configuration, the positions of all the other particles and the configurations of all the other fields, and so it's obviously going to be a non-local theory. But so just, don't want to say anything about that except to quote what Bell said, is that it's a merit of the de Broglie-Bohm version to bring out this non-locality so explicitly that it cannot be ignored. Okay, another sort of aside, I just wanted to say very briefly about why this equation is the way that I like to formulate things, and that's because you can derive that expression from the consideration of what's the most natural way to operationally define the velocity of some point in configuration space, in the sense that if you have a subsystem and I wanted to measure that velocity, knowing that, of course, the position measurement is going to affect the instrumental state of the system. Okay, so stepping back from the universal consideration, just considering local considerations, if I simply define velocity as being, for the ensemble, looking at the difference between a weak measurement at time t and a strong measurement slightly later, given that the strong measurement gave me the result x, in order to define the velocity at position x in phase space, take the limit that tau goes to zero, and that simply gives you this expression for velocity, which works as a Bohmian expression. It gives you conservation of the usual quantum mechanical probability. I think I'm going to have to leave that comment for later because I'm running out of time. Okay, so an obvious point is that you know, nobody would take this seriously unless one could derive orthodox quantum theory from it, and I just want to give a cartoon version of how that can be done. So let's imagine that the universe is comprised only of two systems, an observer O and a system S, and let's imagine that the observer is in a situation that she could assign a pure state to that system S. Okay, so this is an easy scenario to imagine. Then how is that? How does that arise in de Broglie-Bohm theory? The answer is that the pure state that she would apply to the system S is simply proportional to the wave function for the universe with the position or configuration of the observer applied to it like that. So that this is obviously a quantum state in the combined Hilbert space for the system and the observer, and this is just in the observer. So how does that... So the point being here that the position of the observer is something which the observer knows, okay, at least to some approximation, simply by, well, introspection or inspection, you know, depending on how sort of you physically or mentally you want to think about this. And so that's... I'll say more about this later, but that's a rough idea of how you get states for subsystems arising out of de Broglie-Bohm theory. So the point is that we have an instrumental state here arising out of an epistemic state, arising, in other words, out of the observer's knowledge of something, okay? But note that the instrumental state is not a state of knowledge, okay? It's what is known here is the observer knowing her own configuration, and as a consequence of that, being able to assign an instrumental state to a subsystem. So, of course, there is also in this theory a still unknown position of the subsystem, okay? And that, in the theory, we'd find would be guided by the instrumental state that the observer has assigned, and to which the observer will assign this probability distribution. But I want to emphasize that that's completely irrelevant to deriving orthodox quantum theory from Bohmian mechanics. Okay, you don't care about, if you've got a subsystem, you don't care about the fact that it has a hidden variable associated with it. If you want to derive orthodox quantum theory, what you're interested in is knowing the instrumental state of that subsystem, and that's all about knowing other variables, which you can do simply by they're so sort of macroscopic or something, you can introspect what their values are, at least to sufficient accuracy to assign that the state that we know we can. Okay, so going on with how Bohmian mechanics links in with other interpretations of quantum mechanics, I want to give three provocative ways of thinking about de Broglie-Bohm mechanics. So the first, if you like Everett theory, then you could think that de Broglie-Bohm mechanics is like Everett theory in that it has no ad hoc collapse of the wave function. Only it's better because you don't have to worry about the how exactly to define worlds or what the weightings of different worlds means in the Everett interpretation or what determines which world you end up in. Because in the de Broglie-Bohm theory, there is something else in the theory, that's this position, this configuration, which picks out a unique world at all times. So it's like, Everett theory, but without the problems. If you like the Copenhagen interpretation, well, then I'll tell you that de Broglie-Bohm theory is like that because it also has a classical world, okay? But it's only better because you don't have to worry about this ill-defined cut between the quantum and the classical world, because the classical world in de Broglie-Bohm theory is simply a coarse graining of the configuration of all the particles, the configuration for all systems, and so, yes, so it's much better defined. And thirdly, if you like Fuchs's interpretation, I'd say that it's like that, in that instrumental quantum states have an epistemic interpretation. Only better in that your ontology, in other words, what your state of knowledge is about, is not hypothetical events that haven't happened yet to you. Rather, it's your ontology is to presently existing stuff out there, this X, okay, which describes your mind and, as a bonus, the minds of other people as well. Okay. End of that section. Now I want to talk about sort of the issue I've been avoiding, which is probability in the de Broglie-Bohm theory. because, okay, well, just to recap what I've said about the theory, is that it can reproduce orthodox quantum theory given, you know, the kinematics x and the dynamics, which is defined by the velocity, which is given by this expression here, okay, in terms of the universal quantum state, and given this probability assignment, which is also given by the universal quantum state, the obvious question you could ask is, you know, isn't there something fishy about the way psi is appearing in both of these formulas when they're talking about very different things? One is about, you know, an ontic state and how it's moving. The other is a probability distribution. Why should psi be playing this dual role? And I think to try to answer that, you have to go back to a deeper question, which is, what is probability? Okay, when I write down an equation like this, you know, what do I actually mean? And the answer I'm going to adopt to this question, I'm afraid, is just a single answer, and that is the radical Bayesian or Diffinetti answer, which Rüdiger talked about before, which is that probability is not real. Okay, so what is it? It's an expression of one observer's beliefs about whatever. Okay, so this is P of X is one observer's beliefs about X. And this, because we're talking about at time t naught, this is the prior probability distribution which that observer assigns to that. So if this is just one observer's beliefs, then why do we apparently get objective probabilities appearing in orthodox quantum theory? And I think, well, okay, so answer, you know, you might think the problem is, you know, how do we get probabilities appearing in de Broglie-Bohm theory, because it's a deterministic theory. So we can easily rectify that. We can consider generalizations of de Broglie-Bohm theory, which are non-deterministic. So, for example, Nelson's stochastic mechanics, in which you take the de Broglie-Bohm velocity and then add some noise on it, where the noise is of order h bar, and you have this noise term here has this particular distribution. This is Wiener noise here in this instance. So you might think, well, that will solve the problem. But I think it just actually begs the question. You just ask it again, well, what do I... you know, what effectively this has done here is to introduce a whole lot more hidden variables into the theory, okay? This noise at every instant, which varies from, you know, every one instant of time to the next, for every different particle or whatever, is now a new infinity of hidden variables, which are part of my theory, and I have to say, well, why would I, you know, why am I assigning this probability distribution to those hidden variables? Where does that probability distribution come from? Why should that express my knowledge or ignorance about those distributions? So this is not the road that I'm going to go down. I want to keep with the simplest theory, which is the de Broglie-Bohm theory. And I know this is not going to be acceptable to everyone, but I want to at least propose an idea about where the apparently objective probabilities come from, how they can be justified, and that's to use Jane's principle of indifference, or at least this is at least the way I understand it, which is to say that if the statement of a statistical problem is invariant under some transformation, then choose a prior that respects this indifference. So how can I possibly apply it in this situation? So the statement of the problem in this situation has some unknown initial true ontic state, x of t naught, and a assumed known quantum state for the universe, psi of t naught. Okay? Now, there's an implicit here that that t naught, okay, appearing in both of these, no one told me what t naught should be. Should it have been 1 second ago, an hour ago, at the beginning of the universe? That's not stated. So therefore, the problem should be indifferent with respect to whatever t naught I choose. Right? And that means the prior I should choose should be covariant with respect to translations in t naught. That is to say that the whatever prior I choose should obey this equation here, this is transforming, you know, given that I know how X changes in time, this is how the price should change in time. But at least given the obvious things that we might construct a prior out of, that is, you know, the Hamiltonian for the universe, the state for the universe, and the set of X eigenstates, you know, which are the sorts of things that appear in the equation of motion, the only prior I can construct which obeys this equation is the usual quantum mechanical prior. Okay, and so that's what I'm proposing as a way to justify why we should adopt this as our prior. But if you don't believe that, that doesn't, I think there are, hopefully you'll still take away other things from the talk. Okay, so just to get back to, I want to say a little bit more about prior and posterior distributions, to flesh this out a little bit. So remember we talked about the simple case where I had a pure instrumental state, deriving that from an observer state of her own configuration applied on the state of the universe. So this looks unrealistic because it's as if the observer knows exactly her configuration, knows exactly the position of every electron and quark and electromagnetic field within her body or whatever. And clearly that degree of self-knowledge is not realistic, but it's also not required. Okay, that was just a toy model. Nevertheless, it is obviously the case that any observer, as soon as she opens her eyes and starts interacting with the universe, is going to know something about the positions of the particles in the universe. So she is going to assign some probability distribution to those particles, which is not equal to the prior, not equal to this quantum mechanical, standard quantum mechanical distribution. So the right-hand side here, this prior, that's what a totally innocent observer who knows nothing about the universe would believe, assuming that nevertheless somehow she you know, believes something about the quantum state of the universe, but let's not worry about the details. But the left-hand side then is a different thing. That's the posterior distribution. As soon as the observer is started interacting with the universe, she's going to assign an extremely different prior to things. Simply by observing that, you know, there's a piano there, there's an auditorium here, you know, there's a sun in the sky, etc., etc. All those things are obviously apparent facts, which is going to collapse the prior distribution, P prior, to a much sharper distribution, P of X of T. Okay? And this collapse, of course, is purely a classical epistemic or psychological phenomenon. It's nothing physical happening in the world whatsoever. So the configuration, the true configuration, is not suddenly changing, and neither does the quantum state of the universe. Those things are completely unaffected by this phenomenon. Okay? It's just an observer changing her mind about what she knows about the universe. So whatever knowledge it is that the observer has, which is obviously encoded in the configuration of the observer, okay, but that's going to, or reflected in that, is going to encode information about, or knowledge about, the configuration of the universe as a whole, and that's going to define what she expects to happen in the future, just in the usual classical way. How do you, you know, if you know more about what's out there, you know better what's going to happen in the future. And so the instrumental state then of any subsystem which she might interact with is going to be determined by this epistemic state, what she knows about, you know, the probabilities, by this formula here. Don't have time to justify that in detail, but basically that's, I believe, the general way to say how the instrumental states arise in the Roy Bohm theory from classic epistemic states of the, you know, ontic configuration of the universe. So the important point is that in this de Broglie-Bohm mechanics, the pilot wave here is obviously a completely different object in nature from even if I have a pure instrumental quantum state, the interpretation of this thing is completely different from the interpretation of the wave function of the universe. So this leads on to the last section. You know, what is the nature of psi, the quantum state of the universe? So the first thing to note is that in the de Broglie-Bohm theory, this guides the configuration, but is itself unaffected by it. And that suggests that somehow psi is more fundamental than x, less contingent. So that along with the Hamiltonian for the universe, perhaps it's just a constituent of the law of motion. So that sounds like an attractive idea, but it would be a much more attractive idea if psi of t were time independent, okay, because it's rather odd to have a time dependent law of motion, so to speak. And also, it's as things stand, this psi is completely arbitrary. It's the quantum state of the universe, whatever that happens to be, which doesn't seem like a very good situation for something which is supposed to be a fundamental law. So it would be much better if, for example, psi was uniquely determined by the Hamiltonian, because that's something which people are prepared to accept as a fundamental thing. So then the interesting thing, of course, is that the Wheeler-DeWitt constraint does exactly both of those things by specifying that psi must be the ground state of the Hamiltonian. So I don't want to, I'm not claiming that, you know, this is the answer, but all I'm saying is it suggests that a complete theory, including quantum gravity, might be able to realize this hope of being able to interpret psi in a gnomic way. How much time? I've got no time left, haven't I? Yeah. Okay, so I did want to point out that there are other ways of looking at it which suggest the opposite answer. And so just to point out here that you can actually formulate classical mechanics in a way that looks almost identical to de Broglie-Bohm mechanics. There's a very subtle difference between these two equations here which makes all the difference in the physics. And the point is that, when I do that, in the classical case, the wave function which is appearing here is simply a way of encoding initial conditions. In other words, encoding the information which is not stored in the current configuration of the system, because, of course, classically, you require the position and the momentum. So if you like, you could think that this wave function is just encoding information about the momentum of the particle. And so in that sense, it looks like it's a, if I take this analogy seriously, it looks like it's the wave function is acting as something contingent, something ontic, rather than something gnomic. But I do think this also leads to some interesting questions, this way of looking at things. In particular, why does this subtle difference between the quantum and classical cases lead, in one case, to predictability and locality, but in the other case, to unpredictability and the quantum non-locality? I'll skip over that, because I think I reiterate them in my conclusion anyway. So to conclude, what de Broglie-Bohm theory, what does it tell us about the nature of the quantum state? So I think the most important message is that we should not expect to have just one sort of state in our best theory. Okay? Because in this de Broglie-Bohm theory, to fully understand it, what we have to come to terms with is an ontic state, x of t, an epistemic state, which is an observer's knowledge about that, instrumental states, which are determined from, you know, involve the epistemic state, but are not the same thing as, and also possibly a state which we could interpret as a gnomic state. I think it's still an open question about in de Broglie-Bohm theory exactly what is the nature. Does this gnomic interpretation, is it the best one, or is an ontic interpretation better? Then this is what I was alluding to before, is that we have another big question. Given that I can formulate classical mechanics and de Broglie-Bohm mechanics almost identically, why is it in the classical case we can make do with just an ontic state, essentially, whereas in the quantum case we have to deal with all this complication? Can this lead to ideas of toy dynamical theories to help us to explore where the quantum weirdness really comes from? Thanks.
So I was wondering if you could say a couple more words about the slides you jumped over when you got to that synopsis of how you could formulate Bohmian mechanics in the same way as a classical theory.
Yeah, okay. So do you, I'll just briefly go through it then? Okay. All right. So this is now the other way of thinking about the problem, which is to make a comparison between classical and quantum. So one way of formulating classical mechanics, which is obviously closely related to how de Broglie and Bohm derived their theories, is to consider the action, which is the integral of Lagrangian along the true path, the actual path of the particle from its initial position q naught of time t naught to some arbitrary time position and time later. So basically I said this action function encapsulates the momentum of the particle. It's just another way of storing what the momentum of the particle is, because you can simply differentiate that with q and evaluate it at the particular position of the particle in order to find that. Then the way... Yeah, okay, so just to point out that in this classical case, the action functional function is highly restricted in form. So for a free particle, for example, it has this rather weird sort of form here. But given that it has this restricted form, nevertheless, the future evolution of the system is perfectly well described by simply considering this pair of a particular configuration, a particular position, and a function of all positions, which evolve according to these equations here. So this is, this is the equation. This is a Hamilton-Jacobi equation for S. This is the Hamilton equation in a particular way for X, and that's the definition of P. The way to make it look like quantum mechanics is to define a complex wave as just the exponential of e to the I S divided by h bar, and then to ask, so what differential equation does psi obey? And then you find that it obeys this equation here, and I've obviously deliberately written these so that they look as similar as possible, but this is actually a way of writing Schrodinger's equation that makes it look as similar as possible to this way of writing the Hamilton-Jacobi equation up there. And then the only other difference is that I have to use a real part here. And of course, as I said, that this is highly constrained in what it has, the initial values that it can have. Is that sufficient detail for the moment?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and so the other answers which I had here were can we gain insight into the question about how do these different dynamics give radically different consequences by constructing toy theories with other sorts of guiding wave equations, and sort of an obvious starting point is just to look at the classical case, but without putting the constraint on what psi must be. So one could even remove the constraint that it has to have a modulus of 1, and I think it will still give some sort of dynamical theory, although I haven't thought about this in detail, as long as you do the quantum thing and put the real part in there so that you get a real momentum coming out. So anyway, these are obviously very open questions, but that was the idea.
Yep. Anthony Valentini, you stated that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation suggests that the wave function of the universe could be unique. There's actually no evidence for that. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation was solved in the early 90s by Smolin, Ravelli, various other people. And there is an infinite basis of states, of solutions. I mean, there's a contingency there that is just as strong as in ordinary quantum theory. There's an infinite number of solutions. Not true. I mean, there was talk a long time. I mean, DeWitt, at one point, I think in the 60s, was thinking that maybe it might be unique. But I mean, the current work in quantum, if you talk to someone who works today in quantum gravity, I mean, this is just not true at all.
Okay, that's fine. And I didn't want to be claiming that this was an answer. I guess maybe my broader point still holds, is that maybe there is a hope that that in some complete theory that there will be a reason to assign a particular unique quantum state to the universe, and that maybe quantum gravity has something to do with it. Maybe that's all I could say.
Anyone else?
I'll just ask all the odd-numbered questions. So you had a list of Carl Caves's questions for which the answers for which quantum states appeared analogous to distributions and disanalogous to quantic states. And then you had your second list.
Yeah.
So first of all, I mean, the answers on your second list would come out differently if instead of making a comparison with Liouville mechanics, you made a comparison to a statistical classical theory wherein there was an ultimate restriction on how much you could know. And I can berate you about that later. The question I really want to ask is, how do you explain these? So I would say there's more analogies than you've let on, but even given that, you know, you've got five of them on the first transparency, mm-hmm. how do you explain the success of that analogy, given your ultimate view on the nature of the quantum state?
So the success of these analogies?
Right.
Well, that's a good question. I guess in one sense, I think it's, this is a very incomplete answer, but as I said, what something which does come out of this way of looking at things is that there is a strong relation between instrumental state and an epistemic state. Okay, that there is a sense in which the epistemic states are the results of a state of knowledge about something. Granted, it's not a lack of knowledge about the particular system that you're interested in. So it's not a close link there. That's a good question. I don't think I have a good answer to it.
On the elephant in the room, one approach you didn't take was an approach along the line that Anthony did about relaxation to equilibrium type things. Any comment on that?
So I Anthony may talk about this, but I guess I have a in general problem with understanding exactly what it's supposed to mean. In the sense that if I treat probability as being something which is not real, which is just an expression of my belief about the positions of things, the Bohmian configurations of things, what does it mean to talk about the relaxation of that thing to equilibrium? I mean, why should it begin in some non-equilibrium state whatsoever? So, I mean, in fact, what I in this way of thinking about it, I think what's more natural is that you see that as we interact with the world, we have exactly the opposite, that we start, if you like, as a totally naive observer I would claim there are reasons to start in a prior distribution, which is an equilibrium distribution, if you want to use that terminology, but that we very quickly go to a non-equilibrium distribution simply by interacting with the world. Now, it's not the sort of non-equilibrium distribution which allows you to signal faster than light or whatever. And I guess the question about, exactly why that is a deep question, given that there is non-locality in the theory. I think that the relaxation to equilibrium sort of arguments are another way, perhaps, of trying to motivate the prior distribution, but I'm not sure that they're necessary. And the other reason I didn't want to talk about them, because I think it puts too much emphasis on what I'm calling a prior distribution, too much emphasis on, the so-called quantum mechanical distribution, when in fact the actual distribution which I assign to the Bohmian particle positions is very much not the equilibrium distribution given the wave function for the universe.
Okay, folks, I think we should finish there. Could we thank Howard and all this afternoon's speakers once again?